Chapter 5, The CIA, Part 1. On May 24, 1979, a 14-foot bronze statue of General William J. Donovan was dedicated in front of Columbia University's Law School. The dedication speech was delivered by John J. McCloy, who had been asked. Seconds of war when Donovan founded the Office of Strategic Services in World War II. When Donovan died on February 8, 1959, the director of the Central Intelligence Agency, Alan W. Dulles, sent a message to all CIA stations around the world. Bill Donovan was the father of Central Intelligence. He was a great leader. International intelligence, or, as it was formerly known, espionage, was not founded by either Donovan or Dulles, who were merely employees of the World Order. The Order founded international espionage to protect their far-reaching investments and dealings in slaves, drugs and gold, the commodities on which their wealth was built. On November 17, 1843, the port of Shanghai was opened to foreign traders. Lot No. 1 was rented by Jardine Matheson and Company. Other entrepreneurs were Dent and Company and Samuel Russell, an American who represented Baring Brothers. Captain Warren Delano, Franklin D. Roosevelt's grandfather, became a charter member of the Canton Regatta Club, and entered into dealings with the Hong Society. Dr. Emmanuel Josephson states, Warren Delano, Frederick A. Delano's father, founded his fortune on smuggling opium into China. His son, Frederick A. Delano, was born in Hong Kong, and later became the first vice chairman of the Federal Reserve Board in 1914. Although he was the son of an Irish ward healer, William J. Donovan studied law at Columbia from 1903 to 1908. His grades were said to be atrocious, but one of his professors, Harlan F. Stone, took a liking to him. Another protege of Stone was J. Edgar Hoover. As Attorney General, Stone shocked Washington by naming Hoover director of the Bureau of Investigation. Another Columbia professor who liked Donovan was Jackson E. Reynolds, later president of the First National Bank of New York, who backed Donovan's selection as head of VOS. One of Donovan's Columbia classmates was Franklin Delano Roosevelt. In 1910, Donovan met Ellen Robson, an actress who later married August Belmont, American representative of the Rothschilds. There was no question of their marriage. He was looking for a rich wife, she was looking for a rich husband. They began a relationship which lasted for years. Donovan also courted Blanche Lopez, of a wealthy tobacco family, who lived in Rumson, NJ. He then returned to Buffalo, where he opened a law practice. He met Ruth Rumsey, and abruptly dropped Blanche Lopez, never contacting her again. Ruth Rumsey was heiress of one of the richest families in America. Her father, Dexter Rumsey, and her uncle Bronson owned 22 of Buffalo's 43 square miles. In 1890, Dexter Rumsey was worth $10 million. His wife was a member of the wealthy Hazard family of Rhode Island, who had owned 1,000 slaves, and were the largest slave owners in America. The Rumseys were masters of the Genesee Valley Hunt, the most exclusive hunt club in the U.S. Dexter Rumsey died in 1906, leaving his son and daughter 12% each of his fortune in trust. Bill Donovan's courtship of Ruth Rumsey was complicated by the reappearance in Buffalo of Eleanor Robson, now Mrs. August Belmont. She turned up at the Studio Club, an acting group run by Catherine Cornell's father, where Donovan had the juvenile lead. La Robson requested that Donovan come to her suite in New York each weekend for drama lessons. Donovan then took the long train ride to New York City each weekend, causing considerable gossip in Buffalo, where he was already widely known for his philandering. Nevertheless, Ruth Rumsey had determined to marry him, probably because her family was so strongly opposed. Friends of the family stated that had Dexter Rumsey lived, he would never have allowed this marriage to take place, because of Donovan's age. He was 31, his religion, Irish Catholic, and his philandering. The Rumseys were Episcopalian, but Donovan persuaded his wife to bring up their children as Roman Catholics. His brother was a priest. After the marriage, Donovan and his wife moved into the Rumsey family mansion at 742 Delaware Avenue in Buffalo. Because of his New York connections, the Rockefeller Foundation selected Donovan to go to Europe on a war relief mission in 1915, the first of many assignments from the World Order. He was to be separated from Ruth Donovan continually during the next 3 years. While in London, he worked with Ambassador Walter Nelson Page, William Stevenson, who later advised him on setting up the OSS, and Herbert Hoover. Donovan spent 5 weeks in Belgium as an observer with Hoover's Belgian Relief Commission. When the U.S. entered World War I, Donovan helped organize the Rainbow Division, and was given command of the Fighting 69th. He fought at Lanzetland's St. George, in the Meuse-Argonne sector, where, although wounded, he charged a German machine gun squad on October 15, 1918 with his bayonet. For this feat, he was awarded the Congressional Medal of Honor. His bravery was the subject of wide publicity in the American press, and current biography later stated he was the most famous man in the AEF. He was with Joyce Kilmer, the poet, when Kilmer was shot down. In 1919 and 1920, Donovan was sent on secret missions to China and Siberia. After the war, J.P. Morgan established the Foreign Commercial Corporation to float $2 billion in bonds in post-war Europe. In February 1920, he asked Donovan to make a secret tour of Europe to obtain intelligence relating to these bonds. Cave Brown described this mission: having helped to finance the war, Morgan wished to help finance the peace by expanding the House of Morgan's interests widely. These activities required the best intelligence from the best sources in Europe. Donovan and the Rainbow Division intelligence officer, Grayson Malley Prevost Murphy, had been retained by John Lord Abrian's firm to obtain that intelligence, working in secrecy. Morgan reportedly paid Donovan $200,000 for this operation. During his European reconnaissance, Donovan met Adolf Hitler at Berchtesgaden, and spent an evening with him in his room at Pension Moritz. Donovan later claimed he had not known who Hitler was, but that he found him a fascinating talker. In 1922, Donovan was appointed U.S. District Attorney for New York. In 1924, at General Harlan F. Stone, Donovan's Columbia law professor, asked him to come to Washington as asked. At General Donovan and his wife bought a house in Georgetown, later the home of Catherine Meyer, at 1637 30th Street. Donovan's first official act was to demand that Stone fire J. Edgar Hoover from the Bureau of Investigation. Instead, Stone, who was Hoover's patron as well as Donovan's, appointed Hoover director of the Bureau of Investigation December 18, 1924. Donovan also became involved in another political football, the prosecution of Senator Burton K. Wheeler. Wheeler was defended by Senator Tom Walsh, one of the most powerful politicians in Washington, but Donovan, against all advice to the contrary, insisted on proceeding with the prosecution. It was said that the charges against Wheeler were ludicrous, and Stone asked Donovan to drop the case, but he stubbornly proceeded to indict Wheeler before a District of Columbia grand jury. When the case was tried in Great Falls, the jury deliberated only 10 minutes before bringing in a verdict of acquittal for Wheeler. Such a boner would have destroyed the careers of most men in Washington, but Donovan was under the protection of Herbert Hoover, his associate from World War I. Between 1924 and 1928, he was Hoover's closest associate. Hoover took him to the Bohemian Club, the sacrosanct West Coast powerhouse where he was the directing figure. Hoover then persuaded President Coolidge to appoint Donovan to the Colorado River Commission, a 7-state authority which organized the proposals for the Hoover Dam, later rename the Boulder Dam by FDR, and still later, rename the Hoover Dam by Act of Congress in 1947. During the 1920s, Republican politicians favored the nomination of Dawes for president. Although it seemed that he was backing a sure loser, Donovan worked as Hoover's top strategist for 4 years. When Hoover was nominated on the first ballot at the Republican convention, a tribute to the power of the Rothschilds, Donovan wrote his acceptance speech. It was understood that Donovan was to be Hoover's running mate. However, Hoover immediately realized that because he was running against Al Smith, a Roman Catholic, he would lose the massive anti-Catholic vote if he picked Donovan, also a Roman Catholic, as his running mate. Hoover had no intention of losing his trump card in the forthcoming election. He cast Donovan aside without a second thought, and even refused to consider him for a cabinet post, such as Attorney General, probably the only time in American politics that the architect of a successful presidential campaign was denied a position on the team or in the cabinet. The disheartened Donovan decided to forgo political life. In 1929, he organized the law firm of Donovan, Leisure, Newton & Irvine, with offices at 2 Wall Street. He also took a 23-room suite at the Shoreham Hotel for the firm's Washington offices. During ensuing years, Donovan rarely saw his wife, although they were never legally separated. Dunlop's biography of Donovan notes that he always had his pick of feminine admirers. To many of the women he met, Donovan was irresistible. Ruth Donovan stayed at their summer home on the South Shore of Massachusetts, or at their New York apartment on Beekman Place. Despite his disappointment with Hoover, Donovan continued to take an active role in national politics. He ran Knox's campaign for the Republican nomination in 1936, and his firm defended American Telephone and Telegraph in an antitrust suit by the government. Donovan won handily, which brought in a new influx of business to his firm. In 1937, Donovan renewed his association with the Rothschilds. The Viennese branch of the family had lost extensive holdings in Bohemia when the Nazis moved into Czechoslovakia. Because Donovan had already established a network of informants in the highest echelons of the Nazi government, including Admiral Canaries, the Rothschilds asked him to salvage their interests. He went to Germany to argue their case, but despite his important contacts, he was defeated by Hitler's view of the Rothschilds as a symbol of what he hoped to achieve in his battle against the international bankers. The Rothschilds were not overly concerned. They knew that World War II was on its way, and that the outcome had been decided in advance. Donovan won another important legal victory in 1937, when he and a staff of 57 lawyers defended 18 oil firms against antitrust charges. His clients were let off with nominal fines, and once again Donovan was considered the winner. His German contacts now invited him to observe the Nuremberg maneuvers, as a guest of the German General Staff. He also accompanied them on a trip to observe the progress of the Spanish Civil War. Although he was there as an invited guest of the fascists, Donovan was soon to build the os around the hard core of the communist Lincoln Brigade. He met Gim Philby in Spain, who was writing about the Civil War as a pro-Nazi journalist, a pose he carried off successfully despite his recent marriage to Litzy Friedman, a fanatical communist and Zionist provocateur. On April 10, 1940, Donovan's daughter, Patricia, wrecked her car near Fredericksburg, VA, and was killed. She was his only daughter. There was also one son, David, who married Mary Grandin, Patricia's roommate at boarding school, and heiress of a wealthy Philadelphia family. Associates said that Donovan never got over his daughter's death. Because he had received the Congressional Medal of Honor, Patricia was buried in Arlington National Cemetery. His grief-stricken wife left for a round-the-world cruise on Irving Johnson's ship, Yankee. On May 29, 1940, William Stevenson arrived in New York with a letter to Donovan from Admiral Blinker Hall, a British naval intelligence officer whom Donovan had met in 1916. The letter proposed an American intelligence agency, although we were not at war. Franklin D. Roosevelt sent Donovan to London with orders to develop this program, as an unofficial observer. Despite efforts at secrecy, there was widespread journalistic speculation about his mission for Roosevelt. He then made a tour of Southeast Europe for the president, gauging the status of the German-occupied countries. Although this was an obvious espionage mission, the Germans placed no obstacles in his path. They were anxious to maintain good relations with the United States. After Donovan delivered his report to the president, he was named coordinator of information by the White House. Because he had had no experience in propaganda work, the office was later split into the Office of War Information, Executive Order 9128, and the Office of Strategic Services, Military Order of June 13, 1942. Donovan was placed in charge of the OSS. The new agency was from the outset merely an outpost of British intelligence. On September 18, 1941, Colonel E.I. Jacob, Churchill's military secretary, was informed by Major Desmond Morton Church, Churchill's liaison with the British Secret Service. Another most secret fact of which the Prime Minister is aware is that to all intents and purposes U.S. security is being run for them at the President's request by the British. A British officer sits in Washington with Mr. Edgar Hoover and General Bill Donovan for this purpose. It is of course essential that this fact should not be known. For some months, Donovan had been living in a suite at the St. Regis Hotel in New York. He and William Stevenson had been meeting regularly since 1940 to organize the new agency. Stevenson was working directly under Colonel Stuart Menzies, head of Special Operations Executive, the top British intelligence agency. As cover, Menzies was colonel in the Life Guards, the escort troop of the King. Stevenson was head of CIS, Special Intelligence Section. When Donovan had left for London July 15, 1940 on his mission for Roosevelt, Stevenson had wired London, Colonel W.M. J. Donovan, personally representing the President, left yesterday by Clipper. U.S. Embassy not, repeat, not being informed. This was a replay of the House Wilson-Wiseman operation during World War I. Not only were the American people left in the dark, but concerned agencies were never told what the conspirators had planned. Donovan's London mission was a slap in the face to the U.S. Ambassador, Joseph Kennedy. Roosevelt called Donovan my secret legs, and he assured Stevenson in a private interview, I'm your biggest undercover agent. In A Man Called Intrepid, Stevenson is quoted as saying that after April 1939, the president was one of us. It was also in 1939 that Roosevelt privately told Mackenzie King, Prime Minister of Canada and a longtime Rockefeller agent, our frontier is on the Rhine. This same book quotes Churchill as saying, on the eve of war, we need Rockefeller and Rothschild. Stevenson replied, I can find the Rockefellers and they'll support us. We can offer our secret intelligence in return for help. Indeed, the Rockefellers gave Stevenson an entire floor rent-free at Rockefeller Center, where the agency has operated ever since. A later book, Intrepid's Last Case, notes that what some would later call the secret secret occupation of Manhattan began in 1990. By 1941, J. Edgar Hoover was complaining that the Rockefeller Center headquarters of British Security Coordination controlled an army of British secret agents, a group of nine distinct secret agencies. Attorney General Biddle was quoted as saying the truth is nobody knows anything about what Stevenson does. Had anyone known, Stevenson would have had to be arrested and deported. German sailors were being deliberately murdered by Stevenson's provocateurs in New York as acts designed to force Hitler to declare war against the United States. The Intrepid file and so, Stevenson's cover name, described it as a reign of terror conducted by specially trained agents and fortified by espionage and intelligence in occupied Europe. Every act of Donovan and Stevenson was a violation of American neutrality. Donovan's law officer to Wall Street was next to the passport control office. He had special passports prepared for Stevenson's British agents. Stevenson had offices at three locations, Hampshire House, Dorset Hotel, and Rockefeller Center. Alan Dulles had opened the branch office of Coordinator of Information at Rockefeller Center in 1940. He evicted all the tenants on the 25th floor of 30 Rockefeller Plaza, which was the floor above the UK Commercial Corporation, whose president was William Stevenson. This agency was set up after Stevenson complained on April 14, 1941 that Standard Oil was supplying the Germans through Spain, and that it was acting as a hostile and dangerous agency of the enemy. A 400-page report by Stevenson listing Standard Oil and other American corporations' dealings with the Germans was turned over to the FBI in 1941. J. Edgar Hoover prudently buried it. Nelson Rockefeller, as coordinator of inter-American affairs, covered up the supplying of German military forces from his South American subsidiaries. Listed in the Stevenson report were Standard Oil, IG, Farben, a subsidiary of Standard Oil, Ford Motor Company, Bayer Aspirin, Sterling Drug, General Aniline and Film, ANSCO, and International Telephone and Telegraph Company. Sostensby, head of it, had hosted a lavish conference of German intelligence operatives at the Waldorf Astoria in 1940. The German director of it was Baron Kurt von Schroeder, of the Schroeder banking family of Cologne, London and New York, who was Hitler's personal banker. The OSS was actually set up by four members of the British Chief of Staff, Lord Louis Mountbatten, formerly Battenberg, a cousin of the King, and related to the Frankfurt banking families, Rothschild and Castle, Charles Hambrough, Director of Special Operations Executive, and Director of Hambrough's Bank, Colonel Stuart Menzies, Head of Secret Intelligence Service, and William Stevenson, in charge of the CIS American operations. An ancestor of Colonel Menzies had been a notorious Jacobite double agent during the last days of James's reign. The present Menzies was the son of Lady Holford. He married Lady Sackville, daughter of the 8th Earl de Lawer, of the Sackville West family which owned historic Knowle, second. He married Pamela Beckett, daughter of J. Rupert Beckett, CHMN of Westminster Bank, now National Westminster Bank, one of England's Big Five. Menzies' mother-in-law was the daughter of Lord Barclay Paget, Marquis of Anglesey. Menzies' daughter married Lord Edward Hay, Marquis of Tweeddale, Earl of Kinnoull, related to Countess of Errol. The present Sir Peter Menzies is a director of National Westminster Bank, treasurer of the giant Imperial Chemical Industries, and director of Commercial Union Assurance Company in the British Who's Who, 1950. Colonel Menzies noted that he had been appointed C. Head of MI6 from 1939 to 51, but in later editions, he omitted this information. Ford states in his acknowledgements, Lord Mountbatten of Burma was a close personal friend of Donovan as one of the four members of the British Chief of Staff Committee which helped Donovan in the formation and operation of Office of Strategic Services. The American Secret Service was never anything but a British operation, directed at all levels by representatives of the British Crown. OSS agents received advanced training for the European Theatre at Bletchley Park, British espionage headquarters. This site was chosen because it was only 10 miles from Woburn Abbey, where Lord Beaverbrook's agent, Sefton Delmer, operated the British Dirty Tricks Centre and other propaganda activities. Woburn Abbey was the ancestral home of the Duke of Bedford, Marquis of Tavistock. The British Bureau of Psychological Warfare operated as the Tavistock Institute. The membership list of CFR members in 1946 reveals the names of many OSS and OUI operatives: Lyman Bryson, who was with the American Red Cross in Paris, 1918-19, Chief of Special Operations, OUI 1942, and a director of CBS, Thomas W. Childs, Rhodes Scholar, Paris representative of Sullivan and Cromwell. The Dulles Law Firm, exec asked to British Govt. War Supply US, British Embassy, Washington, 1940-45, Partner Lazard Free Rears 1995-48, Holds Order of the British Empire, Leader in English-Speaking Union, Nicholas Roosevelt, American Commission to Negotiate Peace, Paris, 1919, OI 1942-43, Joseph Barnes, Director OI's Foreign Operations, organized Wilkie's World Tour 1942, coined the phrase One World, identified as a communist agent, Elmo Roper, the famed Polstice agent 1942-45, Godin's Megaro, Chief Italian Section OS 194-045, Henry Sturgis Morgan, son of J.P. Morgan, Director Pullman, General Electric, Shepherd Morgan, London Director OS 1943-44, was with Federal Reserve Bank of New York 1916-24, Director Reparations Payments Berlin 1924-30, supervised by Chase Nattel. Bank, later CHMN Nattel Bureau of Economic Research, the Rockefeller Propaganda Operation, John Gardner, OS Europe 1999-45, then joined the Carnegie Corporation Alan W. Dulles Chief OS Europe, Director J. Henry Schroeder, later First Director CIA, John Haskell, OS 1943-44, formerly with Nattel Citico. 1925-31. Another son of J.P. Morgan, Junius, was placed in charge of OS finances. Paul Mellon and his brother-in-law, David Bruce, joined OS. Bruce was in charge of the London office, later was ambassador to France. OS also had operatives from the Vanderbilt, Archbold, DuPont and Ryan families, giving rise to the quip that OS meant oh so social. James Paul Warburg, son of Paul, who had written the Federal Reserve Act, was Donovan's personal assistant in setting up OS. William J. Casey, present head of CIA, was chief of secret intelligence OS Europe. In February 1981, OS veterans held a gala reunion in New York. Present were Margaret Thatcher, Prime Minister of England, Julia Child, Beverly Woodner, Hollywood designer, John Sheehan, who had been chief of OS Special Projects, now a wealthy oil man, Ernest Cuneo, who had been liaison between OS and FDR, Arthur Goldberg, labor lawyer and Zionist leader, later Supreme Court Justice and U.S. Ambassador to the UN, Bill Colby, later chief of CIA, and Temple Fielding, the travel authority who began his travel expertise with OS. One of OS most famous agents who didn't show up was Ho Chi Minh. OS agents became prominent members of the new class in Washington. Archibald MacLeish became Librarian of Congress, Ralph Bunche became U.S. Representative to the UN. S. Dillon Ripley became head of the Smithsonian. Donovan had been chosen to head the OS because of 2 decades in which he carried out secret missions for the Morgans, the Rockefellers and the Rothschilds. When he staffed the agency with known communists, they offered no objection. He had earlier provided unpaid legal help for members of the communist mercenary force, the Abraham Lincoln Brigade. Now he welcomed these veteran anti-fascists into OS. Ford writes, in the OS employment of pro-communists was approved at very high levels. OS often welcomed the services of Marxist enthusiasts. When J. Edgar Hoover, eager to embarrass a rival, sent agents to Donovan with FBI dossiers on communist OS employees, Donovan replied, "I know they're communists, that's why I hired them." Donovan loaded OS with such fanatical communists that they became a joke in Washington. He appointed Dr. Morris Halperin chief Latin American Div. OS. Halperin regularly altered the information which came across his desk to fit the current party line. He often kept his office locked, causing other OSS employees to joke that Halperin must be having another cell meeting. After the war, J. Edgar Hoover testified before Congress about Halperin's communist background. Halperin later moved to Moscow, then to Havana. Chapter 5, The CIA, Part 2 Chief Latin American Div. OSS. Halperin regularly altered the information which came across his desk to fit the current party line. He often kept his office locked, causing other OSS employees to joke that Halperin must be having another cell meeting. After the war, J. Edgar Hoover testified before Congress about Halperin's communist background. Halperin later moved to Moscow, then to Havana. Despite the damning dossiers which J. Edgar Hoover maintained on leading communists in the OSS, he could find no politician willing to buck FDR's three White House assistants, Hiss, Curry and White. Eleanor Roosevelt had been one of the most frenetic activists on behalf of the Lincoln Brigade. Joe Lash gave her a small bronze of a communist soldier, which she kept on her desk for the rest of her life. Donovan even appointed Irving Goff head of OSS in Italy after the Salerno landing. Goff had been commander of the Lincoln Brigade, and was later chairman of the Communist Party in Louisiana and New York. The Spanish Civil War had created an alliance between American intellectuals and the communists. In Passionate Years, Peter Whidden reports that archivist Victor A. Birch, of Brandeis University, said 40% of the Lincoln Brigade were Jewish. Oddly enough, the fascists, the Falam, was led by two Marinos, General Franco and his financial backer, Juan March. March paid for Franco's return to Spain with a $2 million credit at Clwerts of London. In July, 1936, March placed $82 million of securities in nationalist accounts. He deposited $1.5 billion in gold at the Bank of Italy, 121.5 metric tons greater than the gold reserve of most nations. The communists stole the Spanish gold reserve and shipped it to Russia. NKVD General Alexander Orlov, on orders from Ivan Vasilievich, a rare code name for Stalin, loaded Spain's gold reserve on the Soviet ship Komsomol October 25, 1936. It arrived in Odessa November 2. And was trucked to Moscow's precious metals deposit, Gohran, $788 million. $240 million had also been shipped to France from Spain. The Lincoln volunteers surrendered their passports to NKVD officers when they arrived in Spain. These passports were then routinely used in communist espionage. The murderer of Trotsky was arrested in Mexico with a Canadian passport issued to Tony Babich, who was killed in the Civil War. Guzko later exposed a communist agent in Los Angeles using the passport of Ignacy Witsuk. Witnesses saw stacks of these Lincoln passports stacked in the Lubyanka prison, waiting to be used. Ernest Hemingway wrote that the Spanish Civil War was the happiest time of our lives. He modeled his hero in For Whom the Bell Tolls on Robert Merriman, a Moscow agent who was receiving a $900 a year fellowship from the University of California. Hemingway wrote and produced a film, The Spanish Earth, to raise money for the communists, aided by Archibald MacLeish, Dashiell Hammett and Lillian Hellman. Hemingway put up $2,750 for the film, and donated all his royalties. He toured Hollywood to raise funds for the communists, an effort reciprocated when they named his book For Whom the Bell Tolls a Book of the Month Club selection and a multi-million dollar Hollywood production. This was how one achieved artistic success in the 1940s. The English contingent fighting in Spain for the communists included Virginia Woolf's nephew, Julian Bell, who was killed, and Eric Blair, later known as George Orwell. He was in the front line for 112 days before being wounded. He later wrote 1984, a propaganda coup for the world order which claimed no one would be able to withstand their power. He concluded 1984 with the observation that the future would be marked by a jackboot being stamped into the human face forever. Journalists to a man rallied to the communist cause. A.M. Rosenthal, executive editor of the New York Times, said of his brother-in-law, George Watt, commissar of the Lincoln Battalion, "God, how I admired that man. He was my hero." Herbert L. Matthews wrote in 1946, "Nothing so wonderful will ever happen to me again as those 2.5 years one spent in Spain. There I learned that men could be brothers. Today, wherever in this world I meet a man or woman who fought for Spanish liberty, I meet a kindred soul. Nothing will ever break that bond. We left our hearts there." Despite his despair, Matthews was able to relive the glory of Spanish years when he promoted Castro and a band of 6 guerrillas into the dictatorship of Cuba, through a frenetic propaganda barrage in the New York Times. Kim Philby, later active with the OSINT CIA as British liaison, also was prominent in the Spanish Civil War. Son of the famed Arabist, Sir Harold Philby, he joined the Cambridge Socialist Society in 1929. He worked for the British Treasury 1932-33 and was recruited by the Communist Party. In 1934, in Vienna, he married Lizzi Friedman, a communist agent. Witness at the marriage was Teddy Kollek, later a fundraiser for the Israeli terrorists, now mayor of Tel Aviv. Working as a Soviet mole, Philby was financed by the Schroeder Bank in 1934 to publish a pro-Hitler magazine for the Anglo-German Fellowship. The Times then sent him to Spain to cover the Civil War. He took as his mistress the divorced wife of Sir Anthony Lindsay Hogg, Francis Dobble, a Falangist sympathizer whose Salamanca palace became his Spanish headquarters. The daughter of a Canadian banker, Dobble lavishly entertained the Falangist leaders. Philby frequently met General Franco there. Philby was recruited for the British SIS in 1940. In 1942, he helped Norman Holmes Pearson, a Yale professor who specialized in the work of Ezra Pound, to set up the London office of OSS with Charles Hambrough, chief of SO. In 1949, Philby was sent to Washington as SIS liaison officer with the CIA and FBI. J. Edgar Hoover frequently lunched at Harvey's restaurant with Philby and James Angleton of the CIA. While CIA station chief in Rome, Angleton worked closely with the Zionist terrorists Teddy Kollek and Jacob Merida, and later became chief of the Israeli desk at the CIA, helping Philby to set up the lavishly funded International Mossad Espionage Operation, all paid for by American taxpayers. A senior CIA security official, C. Edward Petty, later reported that Angleton might be a Soviet penetration agent or mole, but President Gerald Ford suppressed the report. Top secret files of the CIA and FBI were opened to Philby, despite widespread claims that he was a Soviet agent. Although he helped Burgess and McLean defect to Russia in 1951, he continued to work for SIS until 1956. Under the protection of Harold Macmillan, who defended him publicly in parliamentary debate. In 1962, an Englishwoman at a party in Israel said, "As usual, Kim is doing what his Russian control tells him. I know that he always worked for the Reds." Miles Copeland says that Philby placed a mole in deep cover in the CIA known as Mother. Philby was quoted as saying, "Foreign agencies spying on the U.S. government know exactly what one person in the CIA wants them to know, no more and no less." Philby was finally exposed by a defector, Michael Golensky. On January 23, 1963, Philby left Beirut and defected to Moscow, where he became a lieutenant general in the KGB. On June 10, 1984, Dats Zulk wrote in the Washington Post that Philby was never a Soviet agent, according to CIA memoranda introduced in a lawsuit, but that he was a triple agent. This explains curious paradoxes in the supposed rivalry between the CIA and the KGB, when certain charmed souls float easily back and forth between the two services. agents of either service are eliminated when they find out more than is good for them about this odd arrangement. Entrepid's last case states that for 38 years there was an official NKVD mission in London whose agents were assisted by both British Special Operations and the American OSS. Only now is it clear that Moscow had received hundreds of top-secret OSS research studies, and that the British had supplied guerrilla warfare expertise to the chief of the NKVD's subversive operations, Colonel A.P. Osikoff. In 1993, Donovan was sent on a special mission to Moscow, to establish a permanent alliance between the OSS and the NKVD. Donovan, W. Averill Harriman, and Lieutenant General Fighton and Major General A.P. Osikoff of the NKVD worked out a plan to establish offices of the NKVD in key American cities. On February 10, 1944, J. Edgar Hoover sent a confidential message to Harry Hopkins, "I have just learned from a confidential source that a liaison arrangement has been perfected between the OSS and the NKVD whereby officers will be exchanged between the services. The NKVD will set up an office in Washington." Hopkins was forced to contact A.T. General Biddle to alert the Department of Justice to this operation. Because of the coming election, Roosevelt prudently withdrew his support for the plan. Because of their cooperation with the NKVD and the prominent communists in OSS, General Douglas MacArthur refused to allow any OSS agent in his theater of operations in the Pacific. Donovan went to MacArthur's headquarters on April 2, 1944 and made a personal appeal to him, but was rebuffed. MacArthur considered the OSS agents more dangerous to American security than any military opponents. In Donovan's Washington headquarters, Estelle Frankfurter was caught stealing confidential OSS reports. She was discharged, although her brother, Justice Felix Frankfurter, was Roosevelt's closest confidant. As organizer of the Harold Ware cell, Frankfurter had placed Soviet operatives in many government agencies, and had put his personal protege, Alger Hiss, in FDR's office. Frankfurter's brother, Otto, served a sentence in Anamosa State Prison, Iowa for fraud. While Joseph E. Davis was ambassador to Moscow, the State Department in 1937-38 was ordered to destroy all of its irreplaceable files on the Soviet Union. The Russian division of the State Department was abolished, and the last anti-communist survivors were summarily fired. Since 1935, seven Soviet networks of espionage had been active throughout Europe. Known by their German name, Die Rote Kapelle, the Red Orchestra, they were run by Grand Chief Leopold Trepper, who later emigrated to Israel. In January 1942, Alan Dulles enlisted Die Rote Kapelle to form an anti-German group led by Baron Wolfgang von Pultitz, who later arranged for the defection to East Germany of Otto John, head of West Germany's FBI. During World War II, both von Pultitz and John had worked under Charles Hambrough at Britain's SOA. General Alfred E. Wedemeyer later testified that in 1942 he had proposed a guaranteed plan to shorten the war by at least a year, invading France across the Channel. Winston Churchill argued for his soft underbelly approach through North Africa and Sicily. General Marshall called Wedemeyer before Churchill and Roosevelt to explain his plan, on which he had worked for months, perfecting every detail. Churchill persuaded Roosevelt to postpone the Wedemeyer plan for another year, while the Churchill plan was put into action in North Africa in November 1942. Wedemeyer's plan was vindicated in 1946 by General Franz Halder, chief of staff of the German army, who said the Wedemeyer cross-channel invasion would have been a decisive and timely blow which would have shortened the war by at least a year. However, ending the war in 1943 would have cost the munitions manufacturers many billions in profits. Ezra Pound broadcast on July 17, 1943. "I reckon my last talk was the most courageous I have ever given. I was playing with fire. I was openly talking about how the war may be prolonged, by fellows who were scared that the war might stop. I mean, they're scared right out of their little grey panties, for fear economic equity might set in as soon as guns stop shooting or shortly thereafter. The stage scenery fell with a flop, simultaneously with some anti-Axis successes. What was Pound talking about? Stage scenery, what a cynical way to describe a world conflagration in which 100 million people were dying. Pound exposed the charade. Early in the war, a British secret service operation, Operation Ultra, had obtained the German coding machine. They were able to read every secret order from Hitler and the German general staff. It was like shooting fish in a barrel. F.W. Winter Botham, chief of Air Intelligence, CIS, wrote about his operation of Ultra, the Ultra Secret. He says, on August 2, 1944, which I remember, covered to whole sheets of my Ultra paper, Hitler told Kluge not to pay any attention to the American breakout. He then outlined his master plan for handling the entire invasion. Had Hitler had access to all secret communications of the Allies, he would have had an unbeatable advantage. The Allies listened to all of his orders, and reacted accordingly. Early in the war, Ultra informed them that the Germans were planning a massive bombing raid on Coventry. If they evacuated the city, it would show the Germans they were listening to their plans. Churchill ordered the British to do nothing. The Germans bombed Coventry, killing thousands of women and children. The Ultra Secret was protected at the cost of many British lives. The British also had a double agent, Baron Wilhelm de Rupp, who was Hitler's personal confidant on British policy. De Rupp had lived in England since 1910. He married an English wife, but maintained an apartment on the Kurfürstendamm Dam, as a journalist moving between Germany and England. His closest friend in England was F.W. Winter Botham, chief of Air Intelligence. In February 1939, de Rupp took Winter Botham to Germany, where he conferred with Hitler, Rudolf Hess, and von Milch, head of the German Air Force. Winter Botham writes, by 1934, I had obtained personal contact with the head of state, Hitler, and with Alfred Rosenberg, the official Nationalist Party philosopher and foreign affairs expert, and Rudolf Hess, Hitler's deputy. From my personal meetings with Hitler, I learned about his basic belief that the only hope for an ordered world was that it should be ruled by three superior powers: the British Empire, the Greater Americas, and the New Greater Reich. I felt that his desperate desire for peace was no bluff. At Dunkirk, Hitler told his general staff exactly what he had told me in 1939. It was necessary that the great civilization Britain had brought to the world should continue to exist, and that all he wanted from Britain was that she should acknowledge Germany's position on the continent. Hitler failed to comprehend the depravity of the behind-the-scenes figures of the world order who had gained control of the British Empire with the South Africa wealth they had won in the Boer War. This hoard of gold and diamonds represented the greatest influx of new purchasing power into Europe since the Spanish galleons brought in the gold of the Incas. The resistance encountered in this war caused the planners to resolve that in the future, wars would be managed as precisely as any other business operation. Their philosophy of Hegelian determinism called for setting up two opposing forces, thesis and antithesis, which would be thrown against each other in conflict to produce an outcome, synthesis. Between the two world wars, it was necessary to rearm Germany, and also to back a German government strong enough to prepare the nation for another war. The same people who had supplied Germany from 1916 to 1918 in order to keep World War I going now backed the Nazis to produce a Second World War. The Schroeders and Rothschilds had set up Hoover with the Belgian Relief Commission, in partnership with Emil Francqui, the Beast of the Congo, later the U.S. Food Administration, run by selfless men who inexplicably amassed sudden fortunes in sugar, grain and shipping. Two of these men, Prentice Gray and Julius H. Barnes, then became partners in Schroeder Company, the New York Times, December 11, 1940 noted that Baron Bruno von Schader died at his home here, Dell Park, Inglefield Green, Surrey. He came to England in 1900 and was naturalized in 1914. He established J. Henry Schroeder and Company in London 1904 and in New York 1923. His son Helmut W.B. Schroeder now becomes head of the firm. His partner Frank Cyril Tiex has been a director of the Bank of England since 1912. In 1923, Baron von Schroeder bought the Baghdad Railway. The deal was the biggest ever made under cover of the Lausanne Conference, disposing of former German concessions in Turkey, and the Rothschilds and Lloyds Bank shared with Baron Schroeder in the syndicate that advanced $25 million to start the rebuilding of the lines. The importance of the Schroeder firm between the two world wars is shown by the following excerpts, New York Times December 3, 1923, the first installment of capital for the new currency bank which will grow out of the Renton Bank was issued in Berlin today in the shape of checks in pounds sterling, to the value of 25 million gold marks $6,250,000. From the London bankers Schroeder and Company, whose share in the capital loan is 100 million gold marks, $25 million. Baron Henry Schroeder, who is the head of the firm, has long been closely connected with German financial interests in the international field. New York Times November 25, 1928, J. Henry Schroeder Banking Corporation Finance and Trade Commentary states, if, in the forthcoming reparations conference, the external obligations of Germany are fixed at some reasonable figure, it would be an important step in Germany's whole economic recovery. New York Times, November 2, 1928, J. Henry Schroeder Company floats a $10 million 6% loan to Prussian Electric Power Company in partnership with Brown Brothers Harriman. New York Times, November 14, 1929, the Prussian state has arranged a $5 million loan from J. Henry Schroeder Company to extend Stettin Harbor. New York Times, January 27, 1933, the City Company of New York and the J. Henry Schroeder Trust Company have been designated as German bond scrip agents by the Gold Discount Bank of Berlin. Representatives of American houses of issue said yesterday that they were without direct advice from Berlin, where the Germans and representatives of other creditors are now conferring. The bankers are represented there by John Foster Dulles of the law firm of Sullivan and Cromwell. New York Times, April 19, 1940, the J. Henry Schroeder Banking Corporation has succeeded Speyer and Company as fiscal and paying agent for City of Berlin 25 years 6% gold bonds due in 1950. A leading economist, Professor von Wiegand, has gone on record criticizing the present writer for statements about the Schroeder Company, claiming the firm had little or no connection with Germany, apparently because he had not researched the subject in the New York Times. The president of J. Henry Schroeder also issued a denial in 1944 that they had done any business in Germany. Adolf Hitler had joined the German Workers' Party in 1919 because it was supported by the Thule Society, an influential German society of aristocrats and financiers. In 1921, Hitler met with Admiral Schroeder, commander of the German Marine Corps. In December 1931, the Circle of Friends was formed, 12 prominent German businessmen who promised to donate regularly to the Nazi Party. Baron Gert von Schroeder, partner of J.H. Stein Company Cologne Bankers, was the leader of this group. J.H. Stein then became Hitler's personal banker. Hitler's aide, Walther Funk, met with Schroeder to discuss the real views of Hitler on questions concerning the international bankers. Funk was able to satisfy Schroeder, and the financial support of the Nazi Party continued. Major Winterbotham points out that Lord Montague Norman, governor of the Bank of England for more than 30 years, was Jamar Schacht's best friend. Schacht, Hitler's finance minister, named his grandson Norman because of the friendship. Paul Inzig, in Appeasement Before, During and After the War, says on May 29, 1933, Mr. F.C. Tx of the British banking delegation met with Dr. Schacht, and found Dr. Schacht's attitude wholly satisfactory. Mr. Tx was a longtime partner of J. Henry Schroeder and director of the Bank of England since 1912. His granddaughter married the present Duke of Bedford. On p.78, Inzig says, towards the end of 1936 a new firm was registered in London under the name of Compensation Brokers Limited, which was controlled by the banking house of J. Henry Schroeder and Company and Hambros Bank Limited, with the declared object of assisting with barter transactions between Germany and various parts of the English Empire. When Alfred Rosenberg came to London, he was introduced to many leading figures, including Geoffrey Dawson, editor of the Times, Walter Elliot, MP, Lord Hailsham, Secretary for War, and the Duke of Kent, brother of King Edward VI and George VI. The Duke of Coburg, a close friend of Hitler, had three long talks with King Edward VI on his accession in January 1936. Edward assured the Duke of his sympathies with the Third Reich. In 1965, the then Duke of Windsor remarked, "I never thought Hitler was such a bad chap." The story behind Edward's sudden abdication was that his advisers realized he would not sign the papers for mobilization against Germany. An American divorcee was brought into the picture. She led Edward off to the Rothschild Castle in Austria, while his slightly retarded brother George was installed as King of England. During the mid-30s, three isolationist groups were active in England: the Link, led by Admiral Sir Barry Domville, and composed of genuinely patriotic Englishmen; the Anglo-German Fellowship, organized by J. Henry Schroeder Company with the help of the Soviet Molkheim Philby to lull Hitler into the belief that England would never declare war on him; and the Cliveden Set, who met at Lord Astor's palatial castle, Cliveden, to promote appeasement. On January 4, 1933, Hitler met with the Dulles brothers at the Cologne home of Baron Kurt von Schroeder to guarantee Hitler the funds needed to install him as Chancellor of Germany. The Dulles brothers were there as legal representatives of Kuhn, Loeb Company, which had extended large, short-term credits to Germany, and needed a guarantee of repayment. Alan Dulles was later ensconced in Switzerland by the OSS during World War II. Still later, he became director of the CIA. He had been a director of J. Henry Schroeder Company for many years. On June 11, 1934, Lord Norman and Schacht met secretly at Bedenweiler in the Black Forest, and again in October 1934, to guarantee loans to National Socialist Germany. The J.H. Stein Bank of Cologne and the London and New York branches of Schroeder Bank were correspondent banks often involved in transactions throughout the Hitler regime. Baron Kurt von Schroeder was a member of the Herren Club, the most influential group in Germany, and the Thule Society, which had most Hitler's career in 1919. He was director of all of its German subsidiaries, SS senior group leader, Deutsche Reichsbank, and many other high-ranking positions, listed by the Kilgore Committee, 1940. On September 30, 1933, the financial editor of the London Daily Herald wrote about Mr. Montague Norman's decision to give the Nazis the backing of the Bank of England. Norman's biographer, John Hargrave, writes, "It is quite certain that Norman did all he could to assist Hitlerism to gain and maintain political power, operating on the financial plane from his stronghold in Threadneedle Street." Another Hitler supporter was Sir Henry de Turding, of Royal Dutch Shell, which had been founded by the Samuel family. In May 1933, Alfred Rosenberg was a guest at de Turding's large estate, Buckhurst Park, Ascot, 1 mile from Windsor Castle. Oswald Dutch writes that in 1931 Sir Henri de Derding and his backers, the Samuel family, gave Hitler £30 million. De Derding then divorced his wife, and married his secretary, an ardent Nazi and German. Otto Strasser wrote that Schroeder agreed to foot the bill for the Nazi party at a secret meeting, and guarantee their debts, ending up collecting a generous amount of interest on his original capital. Senate hearings, Committee for Military Affairs, 1945.